Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Becker, in for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. The criminal case against former Enron top executives takes a major turn today. Richard Causey, the energy company's former chief accountant, will become the 16th former Enron executive to plead guilty to some of the criminal charges that led to the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. The plea agreement is expected to make Causey a key government witness against his former co-defendants, Enron founder Kenneth Lay and company CEO Jeffrey Skilling. All three men are accused of hiding massive debt and inflating profits at Enron, which collapsed into bankruptcy in 2001. Joining us on the line is Carrie Johnson. She's financial reporter for The Washington Post. And Carrie, tell us more about this plea bargain. What will Richard Causey plead guilty to?
What we know as of this point, Deborah, is that he's going to plead guilty to at least one of nearly three dozen criminal charges he was indicted on about a year ago. Causey faced charges including money laundering, conspiracy, securities fraud, and insider trading. Those charges would have put him behind bars for potentially decades if he were convicted at trial.
Mm-hmm. So what would cause him to enter this plea right now, do you think?
Well, before any high-stakes case such as this one, plea negotiations always heat up, in part because the defendants in these cases face so many years behind bars. It's also the case that the government was looking for maybe at least one more key witness to bolster its case against Jeff Skilling and Ken Lay, the company's former leaders.
Mm-hmm. And what might he say, do you think, about Lay and Skilling?
Well, we know that Causey was a leading executive at Enron for many years. He joined the company in 1991 as an accountant and worked his way up to the top accounting officer within the entire company. As such, he knew a lot about secretive partnerships the company used to hide debt and inflate earnings. He also participated in several meetings with Ken Lay in the months before the company collapsed into bankruptcy in December 2001.
So it would be hard for him to say that he was just sort of an innocent bystander in all of this and didn't really realize what was going on.
The fact that the government is striking a plea deal with him that gives him some credit for cooperating with them indicates he has something the government wants and can use to strengthen its case against the other two founders of the company.
Now, he was initially scheduled to go on trial with Lay and Skilling, so now this throws a major wrench into things in terms of the defense. How do you think now he might they might attempt to discredit him?
Well, it's an interesting question. Causey is known within the company, or was known within the company, as somebody who was relatively humble given his position and his status. And he did not admit to stealing from the company, as did Andy Fastow, who was the company's former CFO, chief financial officer. Fastow was expected to be the star witness against Lay and Skilling in the upcoming trial, but Causey's plea now sort of supplants Fastow in a way. His testimony can backstop Fastow's, and he may be a little bit more difficult for defense lawyers to discredit.
Right. He has an image of being very upstanding, yes?
He does indeed. He's a devout Catholic. He's raised lots of money for his church. He's a family man who's always on the sidelines at his son's golf game and his daughter's athletic pursuits. He's not a man who flouted his money in Houston.
What about this global galactic agreement that I read about that prosecutors say Causey wrote with Fastow to sort of guarantee profits for some of Fastow's secret companies? How do you think that's going to play out?
That's a great question. That may be the single most important piece of evidence the government had against Rick Causey. Skilling and Lay did not use email. There are few documents that tie them to the fraud if they indeed participated in it.
And what about the possibility of a delay? First of all, that seems likely. And second of all, a mistrial because of the relationships among the co-defendants prior to this plea deal.
Defense lawyers for Jeff Skilling have already signaled they're going to seek a delay of as much as 2 months. It's unclear whether Judge Sim Lake is going to grant such a delay or not. As for a mistrial, I think that's extremely unlikely at this point.
You do? Why is that?
Well, it's not uncommon for defendants to plead guilty on the eve of trial. It's something defense lawyers in multiple defendant cases plan for.
Does it make it trickier, though, because Causey's lawyers knew details about the legal strategy that was going to be used?
Well, it may be a little bit trickier, although remember that Enron has been investigated for more than four years now. It's been pretty clear for some months what the key defense arguments are going to be in the case, namely that Lay and Skilling were misled by rogue subordinates who actually carried out the fraud without their knowledge.
All right, Carrie, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Carrie Johnson is a financial reporter for The Washington Post. Yesterday on Here and Now, we told the story of two languages that are quickly becoming a thing of the past. Mississippi Gulf Coast French and Isleño Spanish were spoken by very small communities in Mississippi and Louisiana. When Hurricane Katrina hit, the few people who used those languages were dispersed, and many predict that these languages are gone for good. Nicholas Osler is a linguist who runs an organization called the Foundation for Endangered Languages. He's also author of Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World, a book that looks at how language communities throughout the course of time have developed, grown, and in some cases, collapsed. This fall, Robin Young spoke with Osler about language empires and asked him to explain how language shapes human development.
Language is what holds a human community together. It's what makes them act as one. By telling stories to each other in that language, they know where they've come from, what's important to them. It's often said that language is what makes us human. I think that languages is what makes us, in a way, superhuman.
Meaning?
You've got the whole community around you when you're speaking your language. You're not having to think for yourself, in a way. You can, to some extent, rely on the tradition that you've come from.
Everyone knows what it's like to be in a place where you don't speak someone else's language, so you're still human,
yes,
but not superhuman,
because
you don't have that support of the community
that's
speaking
right.
to
yes,
you.
Yes, that's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. Well, and so how do you know if a language is alive or dead? I take Latin as an example, as you do. We don't speak it in the streets anymore, but it's spoken.
Indeed. There are some people who speak it. I mean, who speak it every day. For example, Finnish news in Latin comes across every day. And obviously it's used to some extent as a functioning language in the Vatican City. Hmm. You could say that if Latin has died, it's gone to heaven, because if you look at the people speaking languages derived from it, they are the second largest language group in the world after Chinese, and much larger than English.
You say that one of the things that helps a language maintain and stay alive is to have itself in a country that's ruled by the same people for a length of time. But that keeps language
yes.
intact.
Well, indeed. If you have a central government which continues with a particular language, then that is one way that one has a strong defensible center. But even that, amazingly, when you look at history, you can't. If we consider the progress of the Assyrian Empire, which was the superpower of its time, and we're talking, say, 2000 to 1000 BC here, after 1000 BC, although its conquests continued and it was doing better and better, it changed its language. It had been using a language we call Akkadian, and which is found written in cuneiform script, those strange scripts with widges, and it was replaced by the language of one of its subject peoples, namely the Arameans.
Aramaic.
And then that language is called Aramaic. And what that had going for it was it was written alphabetically. Now, it's difficult to see why the mere change of a writing system should change the currency of a language, because after all, people speak and to each other, and they don't have to think about how they would write what they would speak. But it does seem that the Assyrians, in their policy of moving people about to stop them rebelling, had the effect of disseminating this particular language, Aramaic, all over their empire to the extent that it replaced their own dominant language.
You know, I'm going to jump ahead just for a second and say, how unusual is that? Because I'm immediately thinking of the U.S., mm-hmm. where we have an Hispanic population that's growing. And, you know, as I first started listening to you, I thought, well, God, how could that ever happen? I can't imagine that happening, that a country of peoples would just switch their language. But in fact, we may be actually seeing that happen.
Yes, you could well be seeing that happen in the southern and western parts of the USA. I mean, you've got continual Spanish language immigration, and indeed considerable use of the language all the way across the USA. The thing is that, in a way, the United States of America is an unprecedented enterprise as a sort of state created through common endeavor rather than through spreading out of power from a particular center. And what the linguistic implications are that for what such a state should do for its language policy, I'm loath to prescribe. But you do have the situation that Spanish is spreading simply through the spread of populations. Because when it comes down to it, the one thing which spreads a language is migration. It's movement of population.
You talk about M&A languages, mergers and acquisitions languages. What are they?
Well, those are languages which spread through some active government involvement on changing policy. The large languages of the present day, I list the top 20 languages. Chinese is right at the top, and I think the 20th is Turkish.
Mm-hmm.
What you find is that there are two sorts of languages in that list. There are the languages which have got there through natural growth. And then there are other languages, typically European languages, but I think you would have to count Arabic as another one of these, which have got to be big languages through the policy of moving around, perhaps because of trade, perhaps through some attempt at religious conversion, and perhaps also, in some cases, through strategic and military considerations.
Well, it's interesting. I've opened up to that chart of the top 20 languages. As you said, Chinese, Mandarin tops it. How is it that the Chinese have been able to keep their language intact because they have been invaded so many times?
Population, population, and population, I think, is the real answer to that. Well, they were unified in the 2nd century BC. They have kept a unitary government more or less ever since that time. Their population has gone up, and that means that although they cannot always defend it successfully from outsiders, there are always vastly more of them than there are of any people who come to invade.
Mm. Second is English with 508 million speakers.
Yes, you've got, yes. That,
right.
That,
I mean, half, that's a huge jump from the number one language in the world to the second, which is English. And close behind English is Hindi?
That's right. Hindi, Urdu would be another example of a language which has simply grown where it is.
Grown where it is. So the population where it is has grown, as opposed to it spreading around the world.
Yes, that's right.
Same with China. But still,
so it hasn't actually converted anybody.
Right. I was going to say French and Italian are below the top 10. And what does that reflect for you? Because there was a time when, especially in America, you had to learn French or Italian or German, and they're not even in the top 10.
Yes, no, it's that. Well, that chart is a chart of populations, all right? This is actual numbers of people who actually got to speak these languages. This is not necessarily a chart of cultural prestige, you know, and there are languages like Telugu in that list, which many people would find difficult even to place on a map.
Who speaks that?
That's in a central Indian language.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, these things interact. Given time, and there's plenty of time, a language of a nation which becomes unreasonably rich tends to attract people who want to learn it for cultural reasons. That would be the case with French, because French was a dominant language in Europe before there was any French empire, whether in the Americas, in Canada, or later on in Africa.
Robin Young's conversation with linguist Nicholas Osler continues after a break. There is more coming up here and now. Becker, it's here and now. We're continuing our conversation with linguist Nicholas Osler about his new book, Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World. Osler's book begins with the earliest languages, Akkadian, Aramaic, Phoenician, Hebrew, and Arabic. He details how European languages spread by conquest and how languages like Chinese and Hindi have grown because their populations have. Here's more of Robin Young's conversation with linguist Nicholas Osler. He says technology's influence on language should not be overestimated.
Languages can be transmitted now in ways that were never possible before. I mean, you've got this long range spread of oral languages, which is possible through radio and television and more through the internet, which means that it's that not just the written version, but the oral version of a language can go round and can reach, in fact, all strata of societies, not just the literate classes. But of course, one shouldn't overestimate the influence of communication, which is now, in a sense, much easier. The information can flow, it's clear, but it's not clear that people will want to identify with these large range languages any more than they have done in the past. I mean, people's life is in their communities. The communities we started by talking about, which are held together by languages, which are held together by a shared set of stories and recipes and laws. And all those things are difficult to replicate in somebody else's language. All over the world now, we're seeing this concept that in some way those small nations, those small language communities, have got something that the big nations wish they had. And, of course, it's often very difficult for them to get any access to it.
We're speaking with linguist Nicholas Osler. He's author of the new book, Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World. And you're also chair of the Foundation for Endangered Languages, and I feel you were just touching on that. What does that group do?
Well, the Foundation for Endangered Languages is one of a number of groups, which is a charity concerned to do what it can to raise the profile of the smaller languages of the world, the 96% of the world's languages, which are spoken by 4% of the world's population.
Really?
Yes. So the fact is that the vast majority of the world's linguistic diversity is spoken by a very, very small number of people. Mm. And all those languages, and so we're talking something like 5,000 languages here, are in danger of not being around within a couple of generations from now. That will make a very big difference to the world.
How so?
In the sense that there will be a vast inherited range of knowledge which has been around with humanity all along, but suddenly in the flick of an eyelid would no longer be with us. We would be stuck with these big languages, these big cultures, which have been successful in their life, but when the situation changes, one can well find that the success of particular cultures will change as well. If we lose the vast sort of background variety from which our human culture has been drawn, I think we're in some danger.
Give me an example of one of those, the 96% of the languages spoken in the world by 4% of the people. Give me an example of one of those languages and something about that language that would be lost and would be such a profound loss. Can you do that?
Yes. Well, one of them that I've studied a bit myself is a language called Uwa. It is spoken on the borders of Colombia and Venezuela.
Can you spell it?
U-W-A. You might know it better as Tunebo, but
no.
I don't know why they changed the name, but anyway, the Uwa people speak. There are about 10,000 of them. They speak their language. They live their traditional life in that place, but they're increasingly threatened by oil exploration and the intrusion of sort of general Western life, which tends to come with oil exploration. Mm. It's ironic that they are threatened by oil exploration because, in fact, perhaps because oil is plentiful in that part of the world, oil has a role in their mythology as the blood of Mother Earth. They think it needs to be there. It needs to be flowing in there.
Nicholas Osler, so you're concerned about languages disappearing, but is it possible for a new language to spring up in this day and age? A group of people get together and they just speak a different language? Is that completely... Your book details how that happened throughout history. Is it never going to happen again?
Well, I suppose to start a new language, you can either legislate one into existence like Esperanto, which did happen in the middle of the 19th century, and it has a fair number of speakers now, probably 500,000 speakers, I think. If you want to see a new language grow up under its own steam, in some way you need a separate community. That community might be on an island and for some reason cut off from the rest of the world. It could be a community who want to distance themselves from others for one reason or another. And, I mean, you could say that a new language is growing up, say, among the Amish here in the United States, because Pennsylvania Dutch, the language, is no longer the same as the German that they came with. Mm. It's probably still mutually comprehensible at this moment, but it's certainly moving away from it. And so separation is what makes for different languages.
For Americans who would love to have a second language, for people who speak English, what would you say would be the language that Americans should hasten to learn, for whatever the reason?
Well, I think Chinese has got a lot going for it. It's got a marvelous literature. Its structure is similar to English. It's a bit difficult in terms of the writing system, and also the phonology works in a rather different way, so that the tones give it a sing-song quality and make it difficult for us to learn. But if one can get away from the written side and just find a Chinese friend to teach one Chinese, I think that might be even an advantage in itself.
That's Nicholas Osler speaking with Robin Young about his book, Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Beyond Languages, writer Jared Diamond talks about why, throughout history, some civilizations have thrived and others have collapsed. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now.
Rebecca, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As demonstrations continued across Iraq today, protesting this month's elections, the United Nations said the balloting was credible and transparent, and there is no need for another vote. Sunni Arabs and secular Shiites have been protesting what they say was a tainted election, while a Shiite coalition and Kurdish leaders are making preparations to choose a candidate for prime minister. To learn more about what's been happening in Iraq, we turn to Los Angeles Times reporter Patrick McDonnell. He went to Baghdad in June of 2003, shortly after the war started, and stayed until this past July. He joins us from Buenos Aires, Argentina, where he's now bureau chief. Welcome, Patrick.
Hello, Deborah.
Hi. You recently wrote a very long look-back piece about your experience in Iraq, and you wrote it in the Los Angeles Times Sunday magazine. You started writing about a coffee shop girl, a young Iraqi woman who used to work at an American base. Why did you start with that, and can you explain that story a little bit?
This was in the spring of 94. We'd heard about a number of attacks against civilians working on bases, and we'd heard that her minivan was attacked leaving a U.S. base. And I met her at a hospital in Baghdad, in which she was very, very badly wounded. She could hardly see. One of her eyes was destroyed. She was very badly maimed. It was also a very troubling episode because I went afterwards to the American base, and they were they said it would be very difficult to have her transferred to an American hospital and have her treated, even though she worked at the base, where she was very popular, in fact. At the time, it seemed like a novel guerrilla strategy to be attacking civilians, but it's become quite a standard strategy now to murder those people. That's basically what it comes down to.
Right. And what was Baghdad like when you first got there?
When I first got there in the summer of 2003, there really wasn't an organized insurgency. There were people occasionally taking shots at American convoys and so forth, but there still was at that point kind of a hope that this could somehow be put together relatively rapidly, and there could be some kind of democratic process and government that would control things, and there would be an orderly transition. Initially U.S. troops weren't supposed to stay there very long. Another thing about Baghdad, for those of us reporting there, is that, and Iraq in general, when we first got there, it was really kind of a tremendous place to report. We had a lot of freedom to move around. We could drive around to places like Fallujah, which became off limits after a year or so later. You know, it just seemed to disintegrate with every month, unfortunately.
Right. You were in Iraq for some key turning points. In the summer of 2003, you were in the city of Fallujah speaking with an imam who was then killed in an explosion at a mosque. What did you learn there?
Speaking to him and his family, it was becoming very clear that there was all this rage in Sunni Arab Iraq that was kind of being funneled into this anti-U.S. Movement and insurgency that had, unfortunately, a lot of weapons and a lot of recruits to draw from, particularly among the working class unemployed in places like Fallujah and other parts of Sunni Arab Iraq.
You write about going back to Fallujah last November. You were one of the few journalists to go in when Marines returned to that city, and you almost got blown up in a booby-trapped building. Can you tell us that story?
In this particular instance, I was just happened to be walking with a Marine unit, and we got ambushed the first morning of the invasion, shortly after dawn. And well, the Marines there went to the left, and I dashed off to the right into a house that may have been booby-trapped. Some Marines had been in there, and I had to kind of run across a street under a wall of protective Marine fire while people were firing from various angles. So I had to run this 15-foot or so the dash across the street, which was terrifying to me. And luckily, it all ended up okay. But many other people took many more chances, and there were 75 or 80 Marines killed in that, and soldiers killed in that invasion of Fallujah. It was one of the more bloody episodes of urban battles that U.S. troops have had.
Was that the most frightening thing that happened to you?
I don't know. I think about that from time to time. That was pretty. There were a lot of scary episodes during the time that I was with the Marines in Fallujah. But a few in the spring of 2004, I went to Kerbala, which is a Shiite holy city in southern Iraq, where there was a celebration of something called Ashura. It's a very major, major Shiite holiday, and we heard a number of detonations and bombs starting going off in the middle of the city with all these hundreds of thousands of pilgrims around. I was very fortunate in that myself and my interpreter had stopped for a tea at a spot a little bit down the road from where the main groups were, and as the bombs started going off, we had one that went off about 40 meters to our right. People started coming at us at full speed, running away. And then another very large bomb went off about 20 meters to our left, so people were coming at us from that side as well. So basically, we were right in the middle of two kill zones, and which is very fortunate to be able to get out of there. And 130 people were killed in Kerbala that day, so for me, it was a very terrifying experience. But I'm just fortunate to have come out of there.
You know, you write about a deep sense of regret for leaving, but when we hear these kinds of stories, it makes us wonder why.
Well, working as a journalist in Iraq, it's very much kind of a team effort, and we were very reliant on our Iraqi colleagues. I mean, in our bureau, we had 25, 30 Iraqi employees, including interpreters, drivers, guards, and they took many, many chances with us, and more chances than we did, and on many, many occasions, risked their lives to save ours. And in 2 years, one becomes very close to the staff. So to leave those folks behind is very, very difficult and a very emotional thing. Something I'm still processing, still, frankly.
Yeah. The Bush administration has often said that reporters aren't writing good stories about Iraq, balanced stories. What's your perception of that? Are some of the more positive stories being overlooked?
That's always kind of an occupational hazard in Iraq, that one always gets accused of writing negative stories. And the Western press corps tries to be fair in many ways. And indeed, I think that in my article, I cite the example of the landmark elections of January 2005, which were a very, very emotional moment for those of us who were there to see these people risking their lives to vote. And I think you'll find the coverage of that was overwhelmingly positive. However, what we saw in the months afterwards was that despite this exercise in democracy, violence really continued to get worse, and we started to see this whole phenomenon of death squads. So it was a case where I think we were very positive about the election, most of the journalists in town, but maybe we didn't even pay enough sense to the dark side that was lurking there and was pretty evident afterwards.
Your piece in the LA Times Sunday Magazine ends with Narain, the coffee shop girl. What does she say about her future?
It's funny, when I saw her in the hospital bed and she was really just clinging to life, I could sense a certain vitality in her. When I saw her more than a year later, she and her sister were just about to leave Iraq, heading off to Jordan, hoping for a new life. She was still terribly maimed, and she told me something along the line, I don't have the quote in front of me, but something along the lines of, I still have faith in life and the good things that can happen to me, but not here in this country anymore. It's not my country anymore.
All right. Well, Patrick, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for your time, Deborah.
Patrick McConnell is currently bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times in Buenos Aires, Argentina. For the past 2 years, he was the newspaper's Baghdad bureau chief. Still to come, pop culture critic Renee Graham gives us her picks for the best music of the year. You're listening to Here and Now. Choreographer and dancer Bill T. Jones is set to begin his 2006 touring season with a trip through New England. Jones has made a career out of challenging perceptions of gender, race, and age. For a sampling of his art, let's listen back to a 2003 interview with Bill T. Jones. He just staged a piece that he calls The Table Project, in which he contrasts the movements of men and girls, none of them trained as dancers. Here and Now's Lynn Menegon asked him what inspires him.
I was eating breakfast with my companion, and we looked in this diner, and we saw a group of men of a certain age sitting with their backs to us on the stools. And some of them were, you know, big guys, literally coming out of their clothes, and they were very relaxed with each other. And I was thinking, this group of men never think of themselves as on stage. These are the persons in the society who look. They are not the ones who are looked at. And I am a performer. I'm 50 years old. So I said I was probably the same age as these men, but my self-image, my position in life is totally different. I am that vulnerable kind of male who actually puts himself up there for public display. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to make a work that asked these men, who are never the object of a visual judgment, to actually allow themselves to be put in that position, to be lyrical, to be playful.
I'm Steve Grossman, and I'm president of Mass Envelope Plus.
You were also one time the Democratic National Committee chairman, and you were also a candidate for governor of Massachusetts. And now you're going to be dancing on stage. It's extremely unlikely.
A little bit, but when you have those invitations to do the unlikely things, particularly at age 56, almost 57, that's the moment when you've got to say yes with an exclamation at the end of the word.
Hi, I'm Dennis Lloyd. I'm the arts and entertainment advertising manager for the Boston Globe newspaper.
I think this is going to be emotionally challenging.
Not only emotionally challenging, it could be physically challenging and professionally crippling.
Hopefully in their community is with them. But I thought, wouldn't it be even more powerful if this could be then juxtaposed to their opposite? Then who would their opposite be? And I didn't think it would be women of that age. I thought it would be little girls.
So hello, everybody. I'm Bill T. Jones, and I need six very bright, talented, musical, fun ladies to help me do this piece, and it happens on a weird table, and the table looks like something almost like a mountain or a pyramid, but it's a table.
Bill T. Jones found six young dancers at a Boston charter school. Then later, at a reception, he explained to the men what he wanted from their dancing.
Now there is moments in this piece where we have someone on the table who plays King of the Mountain. This is a part that I give to the man whose personality shows that he wants to be the alpha male at that moment. Now, the alpha male, his job is to push everyone around. But there comes a moment in Schubert's music which is called the moment of reconciliation. He has alienated everyone. They turn their back on him. He has to come down from this mountain and individually go to each one and ask for forgiveness. So the Table Project says to me what I think is on the line in modern dance. The modern dance talks about the potential that our body type, our gender, our age, should not be an impediment to us revealing what the real deal is in art making, which is the inner life. When you see that little girl this size do a movement that a man, a huge man, did a few moments ago, then you are looking at spirit dancing. Now that, I think, is the highest goal of art. And without getting too lofty about it, it's a lot of fun.
And the whole thing ends with them all separate, spread around the stage, writing their name in the air. Taking bows together is a very important part of it. Somehow or other, equal, democratized. It's a very very simple but a very profound thing that we see there.
For more information on the Bill T. Jones, Arnie Zane Dance Company, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. According to Entertainment Weekly, 2005 was a disappointing year for the music industry. Music CD sales were down from the previous year, and many industry analysts are wondering why. But Here and Now pop culture critic Renee Graham spoke with Robin Young and said in 2005 there were several musical gems to be found, including Kanye West, who was recently nominated for 8 Grammy Awards. Get down, girl, go ahead, get down.
That's Gold Digger by Kanye West off the album Late Registration. Renee, you think it was one of the better ones of the year?
Absolutely. I think it was the best album of the year. You know, we were talking about, just about a year ago at this time, we were talking about Kanye West, whose first album had come out, The College Dropout. Second album came out this year, Late Registration, and this is the guy we're going to be talking about year after year after year.
Well, Renee Graham, this year also saw the long-awaited return of Fiona Apple, who mm-hmm. came on the scene in the 90s at 19, and she had that long album title back in the 90s. It started with When the Pawn and then went on for 50 Words.
Right.
And she had huge successes with those first two albums. Her third, Extraordinary Machine, was held up. So what's the story of this album?
It depends who you talk to what the real story is. The rumor for a long time was that her label just didn't like the album. They felt it wasn't commercial enough and it sat on the shelf. You know, as things go these days in the internet, someone got a copy of it. It ended up all over the place. There were free Fiona websites popping up. And every track eventually made its way onto the internet, which I think really pushed her label to get it out there.
What's the problem? Why wouldn't they release it?
Well, it isn't an album of singles, but she's never really been a singles artist. That's not what she does. She creates these full albums. She's not just trying for top 40 hits. Unfortunately, the music industry is really looking for lots of top 40 hits, and that's not what she does.
I certainly haven't been shopping for any new shoes. I certainly haven't been spreading myself around. I still only travel by foot, and by foot it's a slow climb. But I'm good at being uncomfortable, so I can't stop changing all the time. I notice that my
Extraordinary Machine, the title cut off the CD of the same name from Fiona Apple. Renee Graham, Fiona Apple worth the wait?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there was a lot of expectation with the album because it took so long for it to finally hit stores. But I thought the album lived up to all the hype. I think it was really a wonderful album that deserved to get released years ago, but I'm glad it finally did.
Okay, let's move on to another of your picks of the past year. Mariah Carey. What a comeback year for her.
Mariah was written off a few years ago. She had a bad film.
The Glitter.
The soundtrack album didn't do well, and she was essentially fired. Although it's hard to say she was fired since she was, you know, given a $28 million buyout to leave Virgin Records. She's now on Island Def Jam. Came out with her album, The Emancipation of Mimi, in April. That album has been in the top 10 for the last 35 weeks.
And she was just nominated for 8 Grammy Awards.
8 Grammy Awards.
Well, let's hear "Shake It Off" from Mariah Carey's CD, The Emancipation of Mimi.
And you keep on playing games like you know I'm here to stay.
Shake it off.
Just like the cats on commercial life. Really gonna get up out of here.
It's a strange thing. I don't think it's a great album, actually. But something in that, the production, she's got a lot of the big production names like Jermaine Dupri working with her. It just connected with people. It's, you know, it's got an R&B element. It's very much hip-hop influenced, and it really did well for people, and people really embraced the album.
Okay, we love your pick for Feel Good Story of the Year. It's the discovery, after a long career, of Detroit R&B singer Betty LeVette. Let's listen first to a little of her How Am I Different.
No, don't tell me, gotta let me guess. I could change it all around if I would just say yes. Who tell me how am I different? How?
That's Detroit's Betty LeVette. Renee Graham, the song is How Am I Different? How is she different?
Betty LeVette is 59 years old. That makes her instantly different on the pop music landscape. She's been around. Her first record was a minor R&B hit in the late 50s when she was a teenager, but she never really broke out. She's played supper clubs, she's played little joints, she's played every little place she could play for the last 40 years, and she was discovered, rediscovered by these younger producers who put her music out, and the album, which is called I've Got My Own Hell to Raise, is a collection of covers all songs written and performed by other women. How Am I Different is an Amy Mann song, and Betty LeVette, as you can tell, there's a lot of living in that voice, and I can listen to her all day. She is wonderful.
Who else was notable for you this year?
I really like the album Howl by Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. They've been around a good long while. They're a California trio, and when they first came out, people compared them to sort of those glam kind of bands like the Jesus and Mary Chain. Suddenly they come up with this album called Howl, and they sounded like vintage the band. It was like music from Big Pink. And it's just really rootsy American music. It's blues, it's country, it's gospel. It's a great album.
Let's give it a listen.
It's easy to fall in love. When you fall in love, you know you're done. You got easy eyes to hunt. And the world above needs your blood. And the cold veins of the richest man will pay you way to steal a hand.
That's Ain't No Easy Way from the Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. Their CD is Howl. Renee Graham's with us. These are her picks of the past year. And Renee, one of the things I love about you is, well, the variety of tastes that you have in music, because we went from Betty LeVette to Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. Who else did you like this past year?
Fall Out Boy had a huge year. This is a band, been around a little while, but this was their big breakout year. All of a sudden, they were on MTV. They've had huge songs. The kids seem to really like them. And they've got a really sort of interesting energy. It's not, you know, overly intellectual music, but it's a good time, and sometimes that's what rock and roll needs to be.
Let's listen to the cut you picked, Sugar, We're Going Down. Band Fall Out Boy, one of Here and Now pop culture critic Renee Graham's picks for the past year in music. But you know, you also write about culture in general, and I know you want to bring some scholarly attention to the oddest story of the past year. I'm referring, of course, to Tomcat.
Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes.
For the uninitiated, this is Tom Cruise's new love. He jumped up and down on the couch.
Jumped, made scuff marks on Oprah's couch, proclaiming his eternal love for Katie Holmes, who apparently he at that point had known all of maybe 2 or 3 hours. It was like watching someone have a nervous breakdown on television. He was pumping his fist. He was jumping on couches. You know, Tom Cruise, who's never talked a lot about his personal life, suddenly wouldn't shut up about his personal life.
Well, but he had a movie, couple movies out, and, you know, they're having a baby, so he, I guess...
But he spent more time, he was, you know, essentially supposed to be promoting his film War of the Worlds, which actually did very well at the box office, but he spent more time talking about, you know, proposing to Katie at the Eiffel Tower. He had this whole, he pulled this whole nutty on the Today Show with Matt Lauer, and he went to this whole diatribe against antidepressants and got in Brooke Shields' business and upset her because she was on antidepressants.
Yeah, but this is what gives people like you something to write about.
It made Tom Cruise more interesting than his last 10 movies combined. You know, Katie Holmes in the meantime looks like a zombie. I don't know what happened to her.
Here and Now, pop culture critic Renee Graham. Renee, thanks so much as usual for coming by.
Thanks, Robin.
Baby, when I used to love you,
that's another one of Here and Now pop culture critic Renee Graham's favorites of the year. It's R&B singer John Legend with Used to Love You. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Rob somebody so we could build like a Whitney and Bobby. It's probably my fault, my bad, my loss.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.